Hello and welcome to Hysteria. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
Alyssa, Variety reported on Tuesday that under Barry Weiss's leadership and the anchorship of Tony DeCoppola. Did I pronounce his name correctly this
yes,
time?
Yes, you did.
I'm going to have to stop calling him Tony Dracula because I feel like
it's funny, though.
It's disrespectful. Anyway, underneath Tony Dracula, viewership of CBS Evening News has decreased 23% year over year. Alyssa, how did this happen?
Erin, you're baiting me with this. You're baiting me with this question. You know, I am like a CBS News aficionado. Nightly news. Mm-hmm. I go back to the Katie Couric days, back to Dan Rather. And when she got rid of my boyfriends, John Dickerson and Maurice Dubois, John Dickerson, a gentle, kind historian who delivered the news with empathy and exacting, like, reporting. And she was like, no, I'm going to take Tony from the morning and put him at night. I don't know what she was thinking. It was a bad decision then, and it's a worse decision now. Sorry, no shade on Tony, but, like, people, here's the thing.
Oh, shade on Tony from me. Shade on Tony. Like, you know.
Fair enough.
President Trump was so disrespectful to the woman he is now married to during
Correct.
The campaign.
Correct.
And he is bootlicking him.
I watched the interview he did with President Trump yesterday, and it was, I wouldn't say it was his finest work, but the thing about it is, it's like, if you know anything and it goes, look, Barry could have shown us that she, like, understood the assignment. People tune into the nightly news because they trust the anchors. You build trust over time. John Dickerson had been on CBS for a gazillion years. Maurice Dubois had been doing his nightly news for New York City for years. And I love them. And I was verklempt when she announced that she was getting rid of them. And so I can't help but say I'm just, like, a little pleased by the stat you just read.
I wonder if Barry is trying to tank the nightly news so she can take over herself, because she seems to be convinced of her own star power.
Do you think by fall we're going to have the nightly news with Barry Weiss?
Oh, yeah. Who doesn't want... What right-leaning American doesn't want to look at Barry Weiss? Anyway, catty, meow. Today, we will be talking about the fallout of last week's shooting in Minneapolis and the screaming, obvious misogyny behind it.
So much.
We're going to be talking about how dark money is making conservative influencers into a new generation of web-sick digital lobbyists. And then our pal, founder of Moms First, Reshma Soojani, joins us to talk about New York's plans to make childcare free in the state. Hey, there's some—
So excited.
Some good news. Then we wrap the show, of course, with Sani Petty. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that is asking the question, is Kristi Noem a bird-legged hoe? And I'm asking that question because music asked me that question.
Is she? What is a bird-legged hoe?
So I'm not sure, but I just got to give some background here.
Okay.
And we asked our Discord community about this as well. About a week ago, I started getting all this stuff on TikTok that was soundtracked with what I've now learned is an AI-generated hip-hop song with a vocalist saying Kristi Noem is a bird-legged hoe over and over and over again.
It's pretty funny.
I think bird-legged means that her legs are bird-like, which I, sure.
Okay.
And I think hoe refers to the fact that she's a—
Not nice lady?
She's a bad lady. I mean, she is married and allegedly has a long-term boyfriend who is also married.
Who works for her.
Who works for her, who is also married. So that is, like, hoe behavior, if we're going to—
It is hoe behavior.
I mean, if we're gonna say it. I mean, I'm just—
I'm comfortable with it.
You know what? Now is not the time for, like, nitpicky 2013 web feminism.
No.
Things are fucking bad,
we're
guys.
We're in the trenches. It's as bad as it's ever been.
In the trenches, and whatever insults we have— And whatever tools we have to fight back and take people down a notch that are on the right, we should use. I don't think that we should kneecap ourselves. If you choose not to agree with me that Kristi Noem is a bird-legged hoe, that's fine. That's your prerogative.
You're right. And we don't shade you for
no,
that.
No, that's totally fine. But I'm going to go ahead and say I agree with the song. I think she is. And I think she deserves much worse than being called— insults, like gendered insults. She deserves much worse.
I agree.
All right, Alyssa. Let's get in. The events of last week happened basically as we were getting out of recording.
Yep.
I'm very glad, looking back, that it didn't happen right before we recorded.
I agree.
Because last Wednesday was a horrible day.
Horrible day. So to get listeners up to speed, in December, the Trump administration began Operation Metro Surge, targeting the Twin Cities area. According to the Department of Homeland Security, it was to crack down welfare fraud schemes allegedly perpetrated by the Somali population in the area, which we discussed last week on the show. The department claims it is the largest immigration operation ever, and thousands of its agents have reportedly been deployed to the area, though DHS has not confirmed an exact number. Reports put the number between 2,000 and 3,000, which is more than the police force in the state. 6 weeks into the massive ICE presence, tensions were high and residents began to protest and push back. Last Wednesday, an unarmed 37-year-old U.S. citizen and mother, Renee Good, was shot and killed by ICE agent Jonathan Ross while she was in the driver's seat of her car. She was killed in front of her wife, dog, and several neighbors. After Good was shot, the Justice Department forewent a civil rights investigation that would establish whether the ICE officer's use of deadly force was justified. Instead, the Justice Department moved to launch an examination into Becca Good's ties to activist groups. This led six federal prosecutors in both Minnesota and Washington to resign in protest.
Yeah. So here's the thing about the people who resigned in protest. Mm-hmm. One of them was in charge of the fraud investigation and had, like, that had, like, helped start.
Right.
That was used as pretext, right?
Right.
And just to review, the fraud investigation had been going on since, I believe, 2021 and had resulted in, I believe, to date, something like 58 convictions.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people being charged, and the ringleader is in jail. Like, this is a thing that they—
Under the Biden administration.
Under the Biden administration and under Governor Walz. And, like, and I don't want to downplay the seriousness of fraud, but I also, like, I think that this also really obscures the fact that fraud is serious and fraud in social services is dwarfed by fraud in other areas of the government. I'm just going to—
Correct.
Yes.
And there's also, they are trying to just obfuscate the fact that this was an issue that was identified, that was being investigated, where charges had been filed, where people had been convicted under Democratic administrations. This was not something anyone was trying to hide.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about Renee Good.
Yes.
Because I had like anybody who saw the footage and who saw the absolutely unhinged right-wing circling of the wagons. Like, Megyn Kelly, whatever shred of soul she had left after defending pedophilia back in December to try to downplay men, like, trying to date 15-year-olds when she's got a daughter that's basically that age, whatever. Whatever shred of credibility she had left is just completely gone. Anybody who defended this after seeing the footage is a soulless shill who cannot be trusted to ever tell the truth. Like, you can't watch the videos of what happened and believe that this officer actually feared for his life. And if he did fear for his life, maybe we should start hiring less fucking fearful men to hold guns. Like, maybe we should do a test when we're hiring cops. And here's what we should do. We should have the cops be like, okay, you know what? Just walk down the hallway. You know, we're going to go to your last exam, or like ICE agents or whatever, any federal officer, anybody who gets a gun. The last stage is you're walking down a hallway and somebody jumps out and goes, boo. And do you try to shoot them? If you do, you fail. You don't get to be a police officer. Like,
But Erin, here is the thing. This is actually a root of the problem is that so many of these ICE officers are untrained. Their standards are so fucking low. If you listen to almost any law enforcement officer who has been interviewed on the news, they're like, what he did is the opposite of the training you get.
But this guy, he was an ICE agent for 10 years. He's been working for the agent. So it's not only he has been, so maybe he was untrained, but he's also been doing his job. This is 10 years of experience. And he was allegedly a weapons trainer? Like, the Call of Duty ass, scared little bitch is a weapons trainer in ICE? He's yeah. teaching people how to use weapons. Like, I've seen footage from Minneapolis of ICE agents holding their guns to the side like they're fucking extras totally. In a gangster movie.
Like, and here was the other issue with him, is that apparently everyone was excusing what he did because they said, oh, no. He actually was traumatized by an interaction with a car.
Take him like, off of duty. Why is he on duty? What a ridiculous thing to be like, oh, my God.
It is an abject failure at every level.
Well, and every lie that they were spinning, Vice President J.D. Vance, who, kind of looks like a demented Campbell's soup boy. He gets on the mic and he spins this series of lies that I think at the time he thought he was being really slick. He's mm-hmm. just so like contemptible. Empty, hollow man who has absolutely no appeal. Like once he doesn't have a boot to deep throat, like once Donald Trump isn't there, he does not have the juice. And I cannot express how unappealing he is to enough people that he's just going to become like a fucking punchline. Mm-hmm. So he goes up there and he spins this yarn. Oh, he had PTSD. He this. And some of the things that he said actually make the government look worse.
Totally.
Like a PTSD sufferer with a documented problem should not be like out
on
there
the
with a weapon, right?
Right.
Like that's insane. That is insane. He fired his shots, one through the dog was in the car, by the way. I know people
yes.
don't care about
yes.
women in this country, but maybe they care about dogs. Her dog was like sitting in the seat behind her, right?
Yes. Poor boy.
He fired through the windshield. He was filming the whole thing, first of all. He was filming the whole thing. And in the footage that he took, that he released to a right-wing outlet, that I think he thinks exonerates him but actually makes him look worse, you
totally.
Can see that he's holding it in his dominant hand when he's filming. And then he switches it to his non-dominant hand and draws his weapon even before she is moving the car in at all. Like, it is
right.
it is so obviously, like, a premeditated, like, video game-poisoned fucking loser who is— trying to create like content and he kills a woman. He fires once through the windshield and twice through the driver's side window. And mm-hmm. there's been a bunch of different analysis done of these videos of the incident, which there's videos from several angles. And analysis shows that he was not in the car's path when he fired two shots. And he wasn't even in danger when he was in the car's path.
He wasn't in the car's path. And again, seasoned law enforcement would tell you when you are in an engagement like that, you step away and you take the license plate number because that's all you have to do. You
right.
don't just shoot into cars.
Also, shooting the driver doesn't stop the car. In a lot
no.
of cases, the opposite happens. And we saw
right.
that in the footage, which is
yes.
horrible to watch. If you haven't watched it already, no. I don't know what the value is in watching it if you haven't already seen
take
it.
Our word for
but
it.
But I
it's
feel
fucking
like
terrible.
Most people have probably seen it. It doesn't stop the car. You're trying to stop the car. You don't fire. You don't shoot at the driver. You shoot at the tires. Was she
yes.
armed? Clearly not. She
no.
she was armed with dog toys and stuffed animals in the front seat.
Window was down, talking to the ICE agent.
Yeah. Her final words, which we see in the video that he took,
mm-hmm.
Were, "I'm not mad at you." And as a woman, what was chilling to me about that moment was how recognizable it was. Like, mm-hmm. how many times, Alyssa, have you been in a situation where things have gotten heated and you realize that there is the man in the situation has reached a point where he's almost out of control?
Yeah,
and you are like,
you just...
Where it's like, I need to manage this for my own
yes.
safety. I need to manage mm-hmm. this person's emotions for my own safety and the safety of people around me. It is such a female experience. And I was so just... When I saw the footage, I noticed exactly, I recognized exactly what was going on. This man was enraged that Renee Good was not sufficiently scared of him.
Totally.
And deferential to him. He
mm-hmm.
was mad at her because she was a woman who wasn't listening. She wasn't compliant enough for him. She wasn't doing what he wanted. And so in the video that the ICE agent took, you can hear somebody call Good a fucking bitch.
Yep.
After he shoots her. Why isn't the misogyny of this situation and the misogyny that fuels Trump world at the center of every conversation about this?
Totally.
Everything. Misogyny is a secret sauce that runs the entire MAGA ethos. The belief that women are less than men and women who are not sufficiently compliant deserve death.
Right.
The fact that women who in any way stand up to the government, who are not scared enough of men, who mm-hmm. don't completely become supplicant to men, deserve death. That's the penalty for not showing losers enough respect.
Well, and if you listen to any, which I made them, I mean, I wanted to because I was curious, but if you listen to Fox News and others, just the way that they describe her, they call her a self-proclaimed poet. She was an award-winning poet. They reference that she was divorced all the time, that she was a lesbian, that she was a lesbian activist. And I want to say, are you trying to say to us that somehow lesbians are a dangerous population, that they're just like they say all of it so coded, like you should be afraid. This is who's in your neighborhood. And it was just, it is so disgusting when you think about the fact that especially more than anything, they're trying to make it seem like lesbians are a dangerous community when the LGBTQ community is 9 times more likely to be the victims of violent crime.
I think that we should really take this as a masks off moment, even though DHS and ICE accidentally doxed Jonathan Ross, the agent who shot her, by telling details of an incident he was involved in that could be easily looked up. This is a masks off moment. There is no more denying that misogyny is at the root of MAGAism. And I know that like it wasn't cool to talk about it after Kamala Harris was defeated by Donald Trump in 2024. It wasn't the thing that anybody wanted to talk about. It's fucking misogyny. It's fucking misogyny. I think that we cannot live in denial that at the center of MAGA is a hatred of women. It's not just
totally.
It's not just like a desire for women to fit into specific roles. It is a hatred. If you refuse to do what they want you to do, it is a deep hate. They fucking hate you and they think you deserve to die.
And here's even an call coming from inside the house example of all of the people in the Trump administration, Aaron, who are utterly fucking inept at their jobs. Fucking Cash Patel, Pete Hegseth, still employed, have full faith and support of Donald Trump. Who has it been reported he is thinking of getting rid of? Pam Bondi, Kristi Noem, and of all of his closest supporters, who is the one he rat-fucked the worst? Elise Stefanik.
Mm-hmm.
Erin didn't even, when she went to run for governor, would not endorse her, endorse the guy who was going to run against her the day she got out of the race.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing that is pathetic about MAGA women. You're a hair away from being a fucking bitch to these people. All you 100%. Have to do is say no once. All you have to do is say no once, and you're a fucking bitch. And the bus, there's lots of room under the bus for you. You know, a lot of people under there, a lot of room under the bus for you. I think Kristi Noem, to be fair, is a little bit of an exception to the rule because she is sort of Corey Lewandowski's flesh puppet at this point, as has been discussed on the floor of Congress by, I believe, the Representative Moskowitz from Florida.
Yes.
Kind of alluded to the fact that Corey Lewandowski, there's also a New York Magazine article that was a cover story that came out several months ago about how it is an open secret that DHS is not actually being run by Kristi Noem. She's just the terrifying face of the organization. And Corey Lewandowski is the one that's actually calling the shots. We need to take a moment and be honest about what we are dealing with, though. I think as a country, as progressives, as Democrats, as leftists, as anybody who's listening to this show who cares about the future of this country, we are dealing with an existential threat to democracy, to freedom overall, that at its center is about control, domination, and hatred of women.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it does for us to pretend that that's not the case or to downplay it, because this is about fucking misogyny, and it's always been about fucking misogyny.
You know, one thing that it is about misogyny. There was something I realized as we were getting ready for the show today, and I couldn't believe it was true. And I checked my math multiple times. But in one of the articles I was reading, it said that DHS had announced in December that the agency more than doubled their number of ICE agents in the last year. The number now is 22,000. If they doubled it, that means they added 11,000. Aaron, those 11,000 ICE agents were given $50,000 signing bonuses.
They weren't yet, though.
Well, but they're promised. Mm-hmm. They're promised.
Yeah.
And just the math on that is $550 million in taxpayer money that could go to these people who are doing nothing but terrorizing our communities at this point.
I mean, serious question. You know, right now we're just witnessing the action, and there's going to be an equal and opposite reaction, hopefully most of which is nonviolent, because I do feel deep down inside yeah. that ICE is out there going door-to-door hunting for one of their agents to get murked and hoping yeah. they can use that as pretext for declaring martial law. That's my tinfoil hat theory. But the equal and opposite reaction may be in the courts. It may be with big lawsuits and giant awards. And guess who's going to be on the hook for those? It's not going to be the actual individual ICE agents. They don't. What do you think?
Not.
They have money? They're like
the government, baby.
They're creaming their pants for a $50,000 bonus that they don't even get right away. It's been promised mm-hmm. to them. They're willing to do unspeakable things to other human beings for $50,000. Mm-hmm. Like they're not doing well financially. You know what I mean? So I think we all need to consider that, like, there are going to be lawsuits. There are going to be giant payouts. There are going to be probably eventually people being thrown in jail, people fleeing the country, a lot of, like, you know, people flipping on each other, jiggery pokery and whatever. But, like, we are going to be paying for this. We're paying for it now, and we're going to be yeah. paying for it in the future. And the thing that's really pathetic about it is, I think deep down, if you think about the way that the Trump administration operates, everything makes more sense if you think about it all as a photo op. He doesn't
totally.
Donald Trump is such a sociopath that he doesn't have any connection to the emotional resonance of whatever scene he's witnessing. He just thinks everything is TV, like everything is as entertainment to him.
He does. It's a reality show. Even, I don't know if you saw, but he posted on Truth Social last night, quote, a day of reckoning and retribution is coming from Minnesota. Exactly. But he's setting it up. Right? He's producing. It's all part of him producing television and photo ops.
Exactly. But also, we also have to keep in mind, because I think it's easy for us to start spinning our wheels and getting really scared, that Donald Trump doesn't follow through on 90% of the things
right.
that he says he's going to do. There's the taco principle. Trump always chickens out. And then there's also the laziness principle and the fact that he's got the attention span of a goldfish with a head injury. And so he is going to move on to the next thing that gets people talking, as long as we're not talking about the Epstein files, right? Because
right.
the Epstein files still haven't been released in their entirety, contrary to what the law says. But whatever, we'll have to talk about that on a different show. So on the note that everything is content, I think that it's important to remember that, like, ICE people have been told to, like, make content, right?
Right.
And ICE's operation in Minnesota isn't, you know, it's a staging ground, I think, for ICE. And I think the reason that they picked Minneapolis is it's the biggest city in a blue state where they have the manpower to make it look like they have overwhelming force.
Right.
I don't think that they couldn't do the same thing in Los Angeles. They've been out here kind of like sneak attacking, but it's almost like to compare it to warfare, it's almost like guerrilla war, where it's like, oh, they don't have the manpower to appear like this is an invasion.
Right.
So they just have to, like, hide and then jump out and snatch somebody.
Same here in New York.
Yeah, exactly. But in Minneapolis, they're trying to make it look like they have the manpower to invade. Exactly. And they are getting a lot of content, and it's hard to gauge. Like, you know, we're always told, film if you see an ICE action
right.
happening, right? But we're also seeing footage of, like, people who are trying to film ICE activity getting their phones taken away or getting roughed up by out-of-control, dysregulated men who cannot control their anger and who are just absolutely pissed when anyone's not sufficiently respectful.
Have you noticed their new catchphrase when they see people recording is that they say they're impeding ICE operations? That is their new way of saying stop impeding ICE operations, stop, and then they become violent.
I heard that there was some reporting this week from, I think, Ken Klipperstein,
mm-hmm.
Who said that that Bovino, I want to call him
oh, yeah.
Bovino because he's
I know you,
such a little rat. Anyway, this little tiny man with a helium voice named Greg Bovino, who's in charge of ICE, who struts around. He set up a perimeter when he went to go piss in a Target bathroom, which is, like, very funny to me. That's, like, I cannot think of anything that's
it's
more—
like the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
That's the most little dick energy yeah. I've ever seen. Like, you got to have guards outside where you take, because you don't want anyone to know how little it
is. It's akin to not getting off your plane so you get the patch for your jacket.
It is a very, that's a very Cash Patel-like thing. Anyway, but Bovino sent out a reminder that's like, hey guys, here's what the statute is that declares when somebody is actually impeding an investigation. Like, and I think that that might have been a CYA cover your ass
for
like,
sure.
move from him, because simply being disrespectful to an ICE agent is not the same thing. Like, there are very specific that you need to be physically blocking a path or like interfering with the actual operation.
And most of what we witness is not even people being disrespectful. It is simply people filming.
Standing there filming. Yeah.
Yes.
And like, that's the thing. I feel like a lot of ICE's giant budget that was promised in the big, beautiful bill will be devoted to paying out lawsuits in the next 5 to 10 years. I truly believe that like that it's not going to be increased border protection. It's not going to be, it's not going to be anything that does what the agency is supposed to do. It's going to be making up for the fact that the people that were out there with ICE in 2026 were untrained, didn't know what the law is, and broke a lot of laws and hurt people in the process. But here's the thing. ICE has a team of video producers that shadow its agents to create content. And the Washington Post published chats in which they strategized how to caption and soundtrack videos, including by knowingly using copyrighted music to go viral. Yeah. So this is in line with how seemingly all government agencies have broken from previous buttoned-up comms norms. The team works closely with the White House to push the narrative and flood the airwaves. I have to just say this. If you are in a band... Lars Ulrich, if you're listening.
if
you are in a band that tends to be used by in hype videos for the corniest motherfuckers alive. So Axl Rose, I think, would maybe be one of these people. And he's like on our team now, right?
Yeah, yeah,
Sebastian Bach, one of those like rocker guys who every once in a while will send out a tweet that's like, fuck MAGA. It's like, you know, whatever. If you are somebody in a band or with a record label, and your label owns the catalog of a band that's used in hype videos or corny guys, like, you need to be a fucking hawk right now on licenses. And or what you could do is you could announce at the end of the month that you are donating all of the money you made off streams in the previous month to fighting ICE, to organizations that help immigrants. Like, there are very funny, trolly, confrontational, cool, like, there's a whole wide range of actions you can take if you're a musician or somebody who deals with the music industry to somehow, like, jujitsu this into something different. Another tip I have, there's also an article that that was about how, like, influencers are being paid to post pro-ICE content. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But I think something that you can do as an average citizen, if you see some like, you know, pro ICE content creator chuckle fuck out there trying to film a video of themselves, like the guy in front of the Somali daycare did, who turns out is like very, very dumb.
Shocking.
If you see that happening, you know what you can do? You can play Under the Sea or any Disney song as loud as you can on your phone. Play, if you have a portable speaker, play it in your car. Play it on a portable speaker, because you know who doesn't fuck around with takedown notices?
Disney.
The Walt Disney Company.
Yeah.
The Walt Disney Company does not fuck around. If you are playing part of your world as like in the background of a white nationalist trying to make content so that they can post it and like harvest the likes, that's not going to go well for them. You can really fuck with somebody's content by playing specifically Disney music. When you wish upon a star, let it go. There's so many that you can do. You can even, I mean, you could start singing it, but I think that that actually might be protected by like different clauses.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I seriously think you should interfere with content creation to the extent that you can. And that's why the protesters in Portland, I think, were so genius, dressing up in those giant frog costumes.
Oh, right.
People dressing up in silly costumes, because how dumb do ICE agents, like, wrestling a man dressed as a giraffe to the ground look? They look like
the chicken,
such
pathetic
losers. Because I think we shouldn't lose track of the fact that deep down inside, ICE is an organization by and for losers, creating content meant to horn up losers. This is loser shit. This is loser shit. And every time you have the opportunity to remind people of that, you should take it.
You should take it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have some good news.
A little bit of good news.
This episode of Hysteria is brought to you by Wild Grain.
Wild Grain is the first bake-from-frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, artisanal pastries, and fresh pastas, plus all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. Unlike many store-bought options, Wild Grain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. There are no preservatives and no shortcuts. Wild Grain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, vegan box, and a new protein box.
I tell you what, during this time of the year, which is a real bummer of a time of year, like late December is like everything is, you know, the shortest days,
This is the doldrums.
But you know what really perks up an evening?
Bread.
Fresh baked bread.
Totally agree.
And Wild Grain makes it so easy to have some fresh baked bread or fresh baked, you know, bread-like products. It is so good. I got a box. It arrived at my door. Everything was, like, in its little bags. You just put it in the freezer, and when you're ready, you take it out, and you put it in the oven, and it, like, bakes, and it's perfect.
And it must, and it smells like heaven.
It smells like heaven. It makes the whole house smell like heaven if you have a partner, roommate, friend, whatever, who comes home after you. Being greeted with the smell of baked bread is just, like, really lovely. You just feel like you're coming into, like, it feels, like, exciting but relaxing at the same time. And, again, it only bakes in, like, 25 minutes or less. It's just a win-win. Also, like, I don't know. There's something so much better about, like, a warm piece of bread or a warm roll versus just, like, a slice of bread, which is just, like, fine.
No,
but
fine.
Warm bread is, like, it's a party. It's a cozy.
It's a luxury.
It's a cozy party.
There's nothing like having an artisan bakery in your freezer to chase away the winter chill. Now is the best time to stay in and enjoy comforting homemade meals with Wild Grain. We highly recommend giving Wild Grain a try. Right now, Wild Grain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box plus free croissants for life when you go to wildgrain.com/hysteria to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissant for life when you visit wildgrain.com/hysteria. Or you can use promo code Hysteria at checkout.
Hysteria is brought to you by Ritual. Ritual takes the pressure off. Their evidence-based essential multivitamins contain key nutrients that are often missed in the average diet, holiday season or not, in high-quality bioavailable forms that your body can actually use. Alyssa, did you reach a point this holiday season when you were like, when's the last time I ate something green?
Oh, absolutely.
Every year, I'm like, wait a minute.
There was a lot of cheese. There were a lot of cookies.
A lot of brown foods,
a lot of white foods. And I will tell you that in addition, Ritual, though, got me through. I did take my Ritual every morning with my cup of coffee. So I know I got that. But since New Year's, I have had a little bit of spinach every day.
But the end of the year, when things get busy, or when you get lazy, or when you get overwhelmed, or you've been working a lot, it's like, it's hard to make sure that you're getting everything you need, and Ritual is the perfect way to fill in the gaps when you're when your diet is various shades of beige. Their Essential for Women 18 Plus Multi contains 9 key nutrients in 2 delayed-release capsules designed for optimal absorption per day. It's designed to be gentle on the stomach, which we talk about all the time. It has a minty essence in every bottle that helps make taking your multis actually enjoyable.
Ritual's Essential third-party tested for heavy metals and Clean Label Project certified, so you know you can trust what you're putting in your body. Ritual multivitamins are vegan, non-GMO project verified, gluten and major allergen free, and made traceable. Instead of striving for perfect health, aim for supporting foundational health. For a limited time, save 40% on your first month at ritual.com/hysteria. That's ritual.com/hysteria for 40% off your first month.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who are taking deep breaths and biding their time. Alyssa, a lot of deep breaths this week.
Whew.
Yeah, a lot of deep breaths.
It's not all bad news.
Thank goodness.
Last week, Governor Kathy Hochul and Mayor Zohran Mamdani announced their plan for universal childcare in New York. So proud.
Joining us for this segment, we have a friend of Hysteria and founder of Moms First, Reshma Soojani, who was there for the historic announcement. Welcome back, Reshma.
Hey, so great to be here.
So Reshma, can you explain for listeners the significance of this announcement and what it means for New Yorkers?
Yeah, it was huge. Look, here's the thing. New York already spends a ton on childcare. But last week, the governor, Governor Hochul, and Mayor Mamdani announced an additional $1.7 billion investment in childcare. And what was so huge about this is that it expanded free childcare in New York City for two-year-olds, which has never been done before.
Wow. That's amazing. It was one of the free childcare or like state supported childcare is one of those things that I'm always kind of like hoping for. And then every once in a while it'll pop up and be like, oh, cool. New Mexico's doing it.
Yeah.
Minnesota, you know, we're all like different states are working on it. It's so cool to see it at the scale that is required in New York.
No, I was just gonna say, because New York City is the largest school district in the country. And like when New York does something, it encourages other states to do something, and it might even move federal policy, mm-hmm. maybe.
I mean, the thing about a city like New York and Los Angeles, where I live, is that there are stories about people having to leave the city because mm-hmm. having children is just too expensive. Like in LA, it's like really hard to find housing that is big enough to house children, plus the cost of childcare. And so people with kids are just leaving. Now, what's a city with no children? Fucking spooky. No. That's a spooky ass place. You don't want a city with no children because children are an essential part of society. And I think expending the money to keep them there is a really important component of making cities remain like vibrant, long-term places for people to live instead of just sort of like corporate Disneylands where people
Absolutely.
Can settle.
And it's also one of the things that are driving women out of the workforce, right? The last job numbers show that the women that were leaving were ones that had the youngest possible children. And they were leaving because the cost of childcare was just too damn high.
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the ethos of Moms First is reframing childcare as an economic necessity. So how has that messaging helped move the cause forward?
Yeah, it really changed the rules of the game. Like I always say, like culture eats policy for breakfast every single day, right? And we had to shift the narrative on childcare like in two ways. One, from it being just like a back burner policy issue. Like we talk a lot about, oh, families are drowning because of the cost of gas and the cost of groceries. No, it's the cost of childcare. Mm-hmm. Like at Moms First, we took billboards out across the country comparing the city's cost of childcare to like the cost of gas. Right. So really shifting the narrative that like, yes, it's the reason why most families are like literally one incident away from financial ruin is because they're putting all their money in childcare. The second being like narrative change was that we've always seen childcare as a personal problem that moms have to fix and not a broken business model that government hasn't put enough resources into. And so we ran a relentless communication strategy, I mean, over the past 4 years that really shifted this narrative from it being this personal backbench issue into it being the affordability issue that we had to focus on. And it worked. And we had to do a lot of things. You know, we took out an ad in the New York Times. We were on CBS This Morning really showing mm-hmm. childcare. I asked Trump that question that went viral, right, about how he was going to fix childcare. Like we did a bunch of means so we could get like the kids and the millennial, you know what I mean, parents to be like, this is important. So it was really this relentless communication strategy that shifted the narrative, I think, that got us to this moment.
Reshma, when you were organizing, did you come across any unexpected partners, people who you thought you might have to convince more but didn't actually need that much convincing to be part of your movement?
You know, business.
Yeah.
Like, I think if you go back, right, Alyssa, and you look at, like, why did it pass in Vermont? Why did it pass in New Mexico? It was because business finally got on the right side of the table. And we have also been organizing business through our National Business Coalition on childcare for the past 4 years. We did this report that showed, like, when you invest in childcare, you get a 425% return if you're businesses. And so mm-hmm. businesses are like, oh, really? Damn, okay. Mm-hmm. And so for the past 3 months, you know, working with Kathy Wild here at the Partnership of New York, we had businesses meet with Mamdani, meet with Governor Hochul, really talk about like, you know, the implications to their workforce on having childcare. Just, you know, 50% of New Yorkers live in a childcare desert. Mm-hmm. It costs $50,000, you know what I mean, to put your kid in childcare here in New York City. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. And so I think the business voice was really, really, really critical, and it's going to be critical in every state that we bring this to. I think the second thing, guys, was that the young kids. Like, mm-hmm. we made childcare cool. And, you know, for years, I was like, damn, like, the reason why we got so loud on climate, where the kids were like, oh, no, you're not, this is my, you know what I mean? This is, like, this is my environment. Like, I'm not going to let you, you know what I mean, burn it down. Mm-hmm. And we needed that same intensity with young mm-hmm. people, right, about childcare. And I think really focusing, you know, working with the Mamdani folks, right, on making this seem like, and explaining to young people, like, they're taking choice away from you. They're pricing you out of parenthood. So even if you don't want to be a parent, don't let them make that decision for you. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Focusing on social media, doing those 3-minute videos, really, and those explainer videos, really, you know, explaining the cost of this, why that this is such an important issue. Like, it worked because we made childcare cool, mm-hmm. right? And if you look at every single rising star, you know what I mean, in the Democratic Party, and damn, even some Republicans, right? They're talking about universal childcare. They're talking about the importance of making childcare. I mean, the Heritage Foundation in their report, what was it all about? Making childcare affordable. Because the kids are listening and it matters to them now. And that was key.
Mm-hmm. How is creating a program like this in New York City different from other places?
Well, I mean, I think, again, it matters what happens in New York because people follow New York. You know, we're the city that, like, we're the home of hip hop and Oreos, right? It's like, it matters, and I think it really drives federal policy. Mm-hmm. So I think what happens here in New York is really, really, really important because we also have we have the most amount of kids, you know what I mean, here in New York City, like in a school system, and it allows us to really experiment. You saw that with 3K, you know what I mean, when de Blasio did 3K, like other people followed.
I was going to ask you about that, Reshma. Do you think that the success of that program helped boost your chances here?
Absolutely, yeah. Because I think there are so many parents, like my kids in 3K, right? And I was like, wow, like this is incredible that I can walk down to my public school, you know what I mean? And I can save $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, right? Which would have been the cost of private childcare or, you know, having someone come in and take care of my son. So like, I think parents understood that and it worked. And then, you know, it also like, for many of us, it's a lottery system.
Right.
So you're like, wait a minute. No. I want more of this, not less of this. And like, what if we actually, you know, were able to go down to twos?
And here's another sort of, I think, I give Governor Hochul a lot of credit for digging deep here because people, I think, wince when they think a new project, a new policy, a new program is going to come to be by raising taxes. Our taxes are high, you know? I mean, the idea of them actually being higher in the city in some is like, it does, it makes you wince. But she actually, these are pre-existing funds that she is, so taxes will not go up in New York City to support this program.
Listen, Governor Hochul is a boss. Mm-hmm. You know, her and I started talking about this in 2023 when she kind of came, you know, into the office. And she experienced this. You know what I mean? She saw the cost of childcare and the impact on, you know, her mother, on herself, how she had to downshift her job, her career, her dreams, how the squeeze that it put on the family. And, you know, I think that's the other thing is having a woman leader that that holds the purpose, because she has the money. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, she's the one who made the decision. And she was able to keep her promises to businesses and say, I'm not going to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's already, you know, for a lot of folks, for a lot of families, it's expensive enough. But I'm going to find where there's waste, you know what I mean, in the budget. And I'm going to prioritize childcare and make that investment. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, like, we're doing, it's 100,000 kids. And a lot more kids are going to need it. And I think you can make the proof will be in the pudding, right? To say, like, look how great this was. Mm-hmm. Maybe you are going to need to raise taxes because one of the things that we do need to do is make sure that we pay childcare workers mm-hmm. an adequate wage.
Yeah.
And childcare workers are not getting that right now, mm-hmm. you know, and we're losing incredible people who love kids and who want to take care of children because they can't afford to take care of their own kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about misogyny in the last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no
Tell
reason.
Me more.
Just kind of the way that it's like baked into Americanism and like the American system and specifically like conservatives in America, like just they are really just a candy shell around a center of misogyny. And, you know, thinking about childcare and the reticence that states would have to raise taxes in order to fund it. To me, it feels like an outgrowth of this idea that women's labor is just something that's owed to the state,
yeah.
as something that is not central for the function of like a society, and to actually devote the funds to it, to devote the funds to supporting women, supporting mothers, supporting caregivers who are mostly women, would to be acknowledging the centrality of women's labor to society in general. And I feel like there's a push-pull. Like, there are people that are like, okay, women who have ever been in a caregiver role, whether they're caring for parents, whether they're caring for children, whatever, we know how, like, the entire world falls apart if women are not there providing the care that is needed for their families to function. But then there's this other part that, like, refuses to acknowledge it. And like, is that something that you experienced? Were there people like on the right that you've, or people who are more conservative who felt like, who it just seemed like they just didn't get it at all? And how do you handle that as an advocate?
Well, here's the thing. I think a couple of things. I would say, Alyssa, it's on both sides. Like, when we talk about affordability and childcare, I didn't hear the word woman. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear about who's the person that we have to make it affordable to or what the impact is. When we make these announcements, we don't talk about how, like, investing in childcare is actually going to allow people to have more choice and freedom and to not be exhausted and depressed and, you know what I mean, and just crushed because of their handling both unpaid and paid labor, and there's just no support. So to me, I think it's fascinating that, like, we talk about childcare from an affordability perspective and not a women's perspective. And here's the thing, I've said this before, like, I'll take it. Because I want to win. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, I want to win for women, so I'll take it. But that is, to me, just fascinating how, like, that's the language. Mm-hmm. I think on the other side of this is, like, it is absolutely true, I think, in the Republican Party that there's, like, this division, right, between the ultra-conservatives who really think that the mom's job is to raise her sons and take care of her husband and that she should be in the private home just doing that. Mm-hmm. And any policy, right, that's quite frankly, you know what I mean, going to make it possible for her to actually be in both places well is not something, you know, like again, I want to see how many Republicans are now rushing, how many Republican governors are like, oh my God, great job, Kathy Hochul, you know what I mean? And the governor of New Mexico, like, me too, tell me how you did it. And we're gonna talk to a lot of them. I want to see, because if you really care about the declining birth rate, if you really care about growing American families, like, any idiot knows that it's childcare, right, is like the linchpin, but you don't see that. Instead, what did we see? Childcare cuts, you know what I mean? Like a threats, political retribution, where we're using American families as like political pawns, you know what I'm saying, in your little, you know what I mean, your own drama. Like, to me, that just shows how we think about this and how much we actually really value, or I should say how this administration values families and children.
Okay, on Monday, we're going to switch gears a little bit. Monday, 15,000 of the city's nurses who work in private hospitals walked out as part of a strike over stalled contract negotiations. Now, we're not saying women, but most nurses are women. So this
88%.
Is
88%.
88%. So why is essential care in the U.S. so undervalued, and how does this story relate to the fight for child care?
Well, listen, because we don't value women, and women are the ones doing the caregiving. We saw this during COVID, right? It was nurses that are essential workers. They were like lifting up our cities, keeping our country, our society functioning, and we didn't pay them an adequate wage.
We did clap for them. We clapped for them in bang class.
We clapped for them.
How many, like, that? They must have like thousands of pot bangings in the bank now.
Thousands. Right, because we don't give a shit about them. And we certainly don't care about paying them adequately. So God bless you for going on strike. We should all go on strike with them. You know what I mean?
15,000 of the city's nurses out there fighting for their own health care. Like, how wild is that? That is one of the biggest sticking points, is their own health care.
Yeah, you know? Their own health care. And they're making 83 cents on every dollar. I mean, it's gross, right? Like, in a moment where, like, people are like, we had this conversation before, like hamburger helpers back in because people can't afford food, right? And now it's like the people that literally keep us alive. We're going to cheat them out of a fair wage. That's just disgusting. And it is about care. You see this with teachers. You see it with nurses. Mm-hmm. You see it with the fact of people who are caring for our elderly parents. We do not value and pay adequately the people who care for us, because we don't value care in our society and we don't value women. So it's like a double whammy.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to see how expensive the misogyny and sexism are to the country, because I feel like a lot of problems would not be problems if only 15, 20 years ago, we would have started the process of getting to a point where nurses were being paid fairly, or where mothers were able to have the flexibility to work and not have to worry about the cost of childcare, and where the people providing that childcare were adequately paid so that they could have lives of their own as well. It just feels like it's all becoming more and more expensive. Like, is there like analysis that your group has like relied on that has like solid numbers about how expensive it is to have women leave the workforce to provide for kids, or like, Do you have any information on that you shared with business leaders that helped move the needle?
Yeah, I mean, what we shared with business leaders on childcare was that you make a 425% return. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And if only 1% of eligible employees took advantage of it, it would pay it back. Like, basically, it's like economic malfeasance to not invest in childcare. And I'm sure we've all seen the billions of dollars that we lose, right, from not essentially compensating women from unpaid labor, or the billions of dollars we lose in the economy, like when women drop out, you know, or undervalue, you know, or like, you know, downshift their careers, right? Because childcare is like unavailable and unaffordable. So like, it's like interesting to me, like everyone knows the numbers on like the business sense of this. I think this is about culture. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think this is about the fact that we've created, and I talked about this, like this zero-sum game, that all of a sudden all these men, you know what I mean, are losing. You know, they're not going to college. They can't find employment. You know what I mean? They're, you know, depressed, exhausted, and lonely. And the reason why that is because we've given women over here all of this economic opportunity and all of this advancement. So if I take that advancement away, if I take that economic opportunity away, and the lever that I can pull is motherhood, because we're the ones who become moms. Mm-hmm. So if I make you feel so constrained, you know what I mean, in doing your paid labor and your unpaid labor, so you have no choice but to drop out. And listen, I'm not just saying this hypothetically. We have thousands and thousands of stories that we're going to share with our documentary that's coming up about how this exactly happens. And if I use this strategy, I think the thinking is that all those open jobs are going to go to all these disaffected men.
Yeah.
I mean, that is like what's happening here, right? It's not, and it's funny. I'm sure you guys feel this way too. I feel like when I share this, people are like, you're some crazy conspiracy talk. I'm like, no, these are facts.
No.
Like these are facts. And like they're implementing a strategy. And that strategy, it's very foundational. Like I'm doing, I'm a history nerd, and like, if you look at the founding of if you look at the very first women's university, the very first women's university was created to teach women how to raise sons and how to take care of their husbands. And it was literally like 50 feet from where the founding fathers were convening to draft the Constitution. And so like, think about like, again, that like imagery of like how this, so they knew what they were doing, mm-hmm. right? And Thomas Jefferson knew that in France they were doing something very different. But it was a strategy, again, of like these orphaned men that were like insecure, that were trying to figure out, well, who the fuck can I dominate? Oh, women, right? Mm-hmm. And that same mentality is happening right now. And so all these things that they do, right? The Tylenol thing, taking away reproductive rights, you know what I mean? The threatening to pull childcare funding, you know, not fixing childcare, all these things that they do, it's a strategy.
Oh, I am 100% under the tinfoil canopy with you here. Like we talk about this on the show a lot, where it's like, yeah, we need to look at this holistically. All of these things, all of these actions taking disparately are troubling. But when you put them together, it's a strategy to subjugate us again, to permanently subjugate women, and to make our only way to participate in society to be through marriage to a man who is in charge of us. Like we have to be his like assistant, and that's the only way in.
And I'm going to go one step further. It's like the murder of Renee Good is also a strategy of control.
100%.
And you heard it the way he was like, fucking bitch, the way he said it right after that. It was like, how dare you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is done to make all of us that are watching be like, you better get back in the house, girl.
Mm-hmm. And there were ICE agents that were caught on camera in the days ensuing, vaguely threatening other women who were trying to stand up to them. The punishment for disrespect is death. And it's completely fucked up. And I really wish more people felt like a hair on fire situation about this.
Well, I think the thing is that here's the thing, right? Because I'm sure you hear this. Like, I hear from people like, oh, I'm just so tired. I'm exhausted. And I think we need to say, yeah, that's the point. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think one side of me as an actress be like, okay, I understand you're tired. Just rest. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of like, no, get the fuck up. Mm-hmm. Like, we all got to get the fuck up because we have a limited amount of time. And we have to, like, there's this cognitive dissonance, right, on connecting the dots. That's what you're doing here, you know, what we're doing at Moms First in terms of the communication and explaining this to people and connecting the dots to it and backing it up with real data mm-hmm. is really important because, again, this is a strategy that is being implemented. And we got nothing else. On the other side, there is nothing else to con. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That is pushing back. In fact, you're seeing supermajority shut down, Planned Parenthood get defunded, women's organizations, you know what I mean? Like the women's voice, you know what I mean, in the left or the middle is being silenced.
Mm-hmm. I mean, talk about being a history nerd. I think that people who think that it can't happen here and they think if they just chill out and like unplug for a little bit, they'll just like turn off the program yeah. and turn it back on and then they'll be in the third act when everything's fine. Like, I don't think that they, like, read about Iran, you know, read about places where, like, people's rights disappeared overnight, specifically women's, read about Romania, read about, yeah. like, many, like, American history, the arc of history bending toward justice is an exception in no. world history. It is not the fucking rule. And I think that people, I mean, it's really encouraging to see wins like New York City committing to recognizing the humanity in women and the value of work and the humanity in children
yeah.
and the value in having them be provided for and cared for. Those are good.
And moms and women did this.
Yes.
Moms, all these groups, Alliance for Quality Education, Jennifer Gutierrez, Moms, we did this. Like yeah. women's organizations and women's leaders came together and got that win to happen.
And I have to say, you know, we have some men that listen to this podcast, believe it or not. And mm-hmm. if you are a man with a tired woman in your life, maybe now would be the time to step up and do a little yes. bit more than you've been doing. I've seen a lot of women at protests that I've gone to, a lot of women that are graying women, a lot of women over 60, a lot of the like cringe lib boomers that people were making fun
They're
of.
They're the ones that are saving our country.
They are right the now. Ones that are standing mm-hmm. up, and I bet they are yeah. fucking tired. And if there's one of them in your life and she wants to take a little break and you're like, you know what, I feel like I have a little bit more in the tank today, I can give a little bit more, you can be like, you know what, Brenda, I don't know. You chill out and watch a movie. I'm gonna go like make some signs, and then we'll like go out and like distribute literature together or whatever. You know, this is a time where if you're somebody who hasn't been standing up to stand up, because women like you, Reshma, and other moms and people that are working their asses off are probably pretty tired, and they're going to be tired for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
So yeah,
and it's like, I'd rather be tired than dead.
That's true.
And that's kind of how I feel right now, which is like, this is like, we're at a level 10.
Yeah.
You yeah. know? And so we have like this window of opportunity and to turn it around. Like, I think about this like years, like, you know, like 2 years ago, if every woman at a company, when they started shutting down your ERG or not funding the local Girls Who Code Club, you know what I mean? Or if you had said, yeah, you do that and I'm gone. Right? We might be like, we're being tested to see how far can they go. And I think now's the moment. Like, to me, it's like French Revolution vibes. Like, I'm all in. Like, what are we wearing? And it's gotta, I mean, here's the other thing, right? It's like on the right, they got like Make America Hot Again and they got trad wives. But what do we have?
Right.
What do we have, right?
Normal people.
But it's got to feel fun, right?
Yeah.
It's got to feel joyful. It's got to feel hot. It's got to feel like not exhaust. It's got to feel strong. Like, mm-hmm. and I think like three, I don't know about you, like when I go out and I armor up, I'm like, I'm ready. Bring it, you mm-hmm. know, like, and I do feel strong and I do feel proud and I do feel tired too, but it can't feel like such a, you know, such a downer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My daughter, who's 4, is obsessed with Spider-Man, and she dressed up like Spider-Man to come with me to the, there was like a small protest in our neighborhood, like an anti-ICE protest on this weekend, and she dressed up like Spider-Man and went to the protest and had her own sign that said like, villains go home, you know, like, and bad guys get out, you know, like stuff that signs a Spider-Man would hold. And people at the protest were like so happy to see her. And she was like so happy to be there. And it just was like such a good experience to share space with people that it's like, okay, you're here, I'm here. This isn't the cesspool of the internet. We are all here and we all believe in the same things. And I sometimes think that like just getting out there and like being in public with people who feel strongly about that as well. Reshma, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for
having me.
This
was great, as always. I feel like running through a wall after talking to you, like in a good way, like in a Kool-Aid man kind of way.
Thank you. Thank you. That's what I'm going for, so I appreciate that.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more hysteria.
Hysteria is brought to you by Smalls. Erin, January is when we all try to reset, including the cats.
Mm.
Because the cats, they had little parties in their mouths over the holiday, just like I did.
What are their favorite non-cat food foods that they should not be having?
Anything out of the oven. Chicken, turkey. Now, I try to make it no garlic, no onions, no spices, just, you know, salt. But it's, let's just say that we have to break tiny baby cat of her addiction right now, because every time I open the fridge and open a Tupperware, she thinks it's turkey and she goes,
and that's so a good cat impression.
It's they all have different sounds, right? But hers is and Big Bert, her sister, who's actually her little sister, when she hears the chirping, she comes lumbering around the corner like I'm here. And anyway, we've had to reset, and the fridge is staying closed, and Smalls is coming back out.
Amazing. Well, this podcast is sponsored by Smalls. For a limited time, you can get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/hysteria. Smalls cat food is protein-packed recipes made with preservative-free ingredients you'd find in your fridge. Except, you know, not the kind of stuff you'd put in your oven.
No.
It's delivered right to your door. That's why cats.com named Smalls their best overall cat food. Man, this is great.
Yeah, it's like an easy trick, you know, because it smells good and, you know, they get to the end and then they're like, this wasn't what I was thinking, but I'm full now, so I'll see you later.
I'm full now and I haven't eaten something I wasn't supposed to eat.
Exactly.
Starting with Smalls is easy. Just share info about your cat's health, diet, and food preferences. Then Smalls puts together a personalized sampler for your cat. Oh my gosh, like a flight?
A flight.
A flight of cat food. No more picking between random brands at the store. Smalls has the right food to satisfy any cat's cravings. Still not a believer in Smalls? Forbes ranks Smalls the best overall cat food, while BuzzFeed said, my cats went completely ballistic for this stuff.
They love it.
They love it.
After switching to Smalls, 88% of cat owners reported overall health improvements. That's a big deal. I know our litter box gets a lot nicer once they've started back on the Smalls. And the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. That means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food. Make 2026 your cat's healthiest year yet for a limited time, because you're a Hysteria listener. Get 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/hysteria. One last time, that's 60% off your first order plus free shipping when you head to smalls.com/hysteria.
And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast for people who are disappointed to learn that the viral tidbit about Donald Trump smelling like rotten roast beef and farting during meetings was from a satirical paper.
It's disgusting.
So just a little background for people who do not have my exact same FYP on TikTok. there was like a text block that went kind of viral, and people started discussing the text block. And the text said that an oil executive at the meeting with Donald Trump, where he got up and just randomly went to the window and looked out at the East Wing construction site, there was a text block that said that an oil executive reported that Trump smelled like rotten roast beef and was farting the whole time. Now, the first time I saw that discussed, I was like, hilarious. Yes, that tracks. But then, because we live in a disinformation environment, and I do not like to be made a fool of, I was like, wait a minute, where is this from? So I typed the text exactly into a search bar, and I found that it was from a tweet from a satirical publication that isn't that funny, right? So it was a teaching moment for me, because it was like confirmation bias. Although I will say that Adam Kinzinger, the former Illinois congressperson, sure, has mentioned in the past that Donald Trump does stink. And I think it's reasonable to assume that a man who eats beef and requires 10 to 20 flushes to get his toilet materials to descend fully into the septic system. It's fair to assume that he probably doesn't smell great, right?
I would imagine. No vegetables, only very well done meat. It can't be good.
Yeah, yeah. He's just, and all that like makeup and whatever. I'm sure he has like a gross cloying cologne smell or whatever. But anyway, so
something adjacent rotten roast beef.
Something adjacent to rotten roast beef, but not rotten roast beef as reported by an oil exec. That was a fake post.
That was a joke.
And it was a joke post that I fell for at first because it told me something that I wanted to hear. And on that note, we're going to talk a little bit about the very nature of reality being manipulated before our eyes. And it's really important for us as like consumers of media, consumers of content, and people who are trying to just learn about the world around them to be wary about how they're taking information in, who is providing information, and how that all works. Okay? So it's really hard to tell the difference between, you know, advertising, entertainment, and lobbying, because no matter how many guidelines the FTC puts in place, they never seem to be enforced at scale, and there's always ways to dodge them. So there are political, corporate, and foreign interests that are trading traditional lobbying tactics for influencer campaigns.
Yeah.
Okay. And so by that, I mean, let's say, Alyssa, you're somebody who works for the coal industry.
Oh,
and you really, and you really want people to think that coal is awesome and that it would be good if another coal mine opened. Rather than going to a traditional lobbyist who would take a member of Congress out to lunch and like get them nice and drunk or whatever, and be like, yeah, please, like do the coal, or like let's go golfing and talk about coal or whatever. Instead of doing that, what they're doing is they're just writing checks to influencers with large follower counts to write posts that are in favor of coal. So what does that mean at scale? It means that when you go online and you see a giant MAGA account or several MAGA accounts suddenly tweeting about the same thing, or people on Instagram suddenly posting about the same thing, there's a good chance that what you're seeing is the result of somebody being paid to express an opinion. And that's kind of scary.
Yeah. I mean, because it circumvents all of the laws that have sort of like properly been put in place over the years, you know? Like a lot of these influencers are working on behalf of foreign governments, which there is an entire act, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, the FARA Act, that if you are working on behalf of not just a government but a principal of a government, that you have to register with the Department of Justice so that people know that you are working on behalf of this government. If the government's just paying an influencer and the influencer's tweeting, there is no reportage. There is no understood link between the two. It is just someone who has the trust of their followers pointing them in a direction that they otherwise would probably know nothing about.
And here's the thing. Okay, so the Wall Street Journal actually published a long-form piece about this this week, talking about how pervasive the strategy has become. Like, if it seems like the internet is a cesspool, it's because it literally is. And a lot of the content you're seeing is paid content. Marijuana content, Qatari content, MAHA stuff. Israel does this all the time. They all lobby to get creator, they all give creators big checks and expensive experiences, including trips. Qatar was paying for like influencers to go on trips to Doha, which
get ready with me.
I mean, I spent like 13 hours in the Doha airport on a layover one time, and the airport does slap, but the city itself is like, whoa, I don't think this should be here. Like, no. It's like being in a circus. You're like, this shouldn't. This doesn't go here.
Feels fake.
Yeah, feels pretty fake. Trump's 28-year-old former campaign aide, Alex Brusewitz, shared a message urging the White House to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug to his 640,000 ex-followers. And then in December, Trump overrode objections from Republican lawmakers and directed the federal government to reclassify the drug. So here's the reason this is so dangerous. Because not only are we spending all our time in the quote-unquote digital public square of social media, government officials, nobody needs to log off more than Republican members of Congress.
Right.
They are so websick. They are completely too online, terminally online. They are too online. And so the reality for them, the way that they are receiving information is in a lot of times from spaces and within spaces that can be and are manipulated to make right. reality appear different than it actually is. And I think it's really important for us to I wanted to talk about this because I think it's really important. Like, I had a friend who was on Instagram and was like, I can't believe there's all these comments supporting the ICE agent, you know, after mm-hmm. Renee Good was killed.
Right.
And the truth is some of those posts are probably real people. But I think it's really important to consider how many of those real people are encouraged by influencer campaigns to make their opinion look more popular than it is.
For sure. And like, if you think back to, you know, this is sort of like lobbying on steroids. Mm-hmm. Like you said, the lobbying is a lobbyist who the member of Congress knows works for a company and is going to come and try to sell them on something. So, you know, they've got their like, they've got their antennae up. This is almost like a fear-based guerrilla lobbying.
Yeah.
You know, this is 640,000 people on Twitter. Like, there were articles a couple weeks ago that Laura Loomer receives money from companies so she won't tweet about them. So mm-hmm. she won't go after them because she is so, her tweets are so damaging.
Oh my God, get that it bag, is, girl. It is, that is.
It is. I mean, Erin, they were talking, some of these companies pay her upwards of $200,000 or $300,000 to not tweet about them. You know, and so it's like at this point, nothing, like nothing's on the level.
Nothing's on the level. And also the thing that really freaks me out, and we're going to get a little bit like dead internet theory here, dead internet mm-hmm. theory, the belief that many of the alleged profiles on the internet are actually bots and not real
yeah,
people.
Sure.
I think that a lot of these people with giant follower counts actually are followed in many cases by bots. There's tons of bots. So, like, these companies that think they're paying, you know, the former Trump campaign aide to message to 640,000 humans are actually not reaching 640,000 humans. Who can say how many humans they're actually reaching?
Right. Well, but what it does reach, right, is that the Trump administration sees this person has 640,000 followers, gets nervous, mm-hmm. and is like, okay. So, right, it's like this sort of self-fulfilling, it's a circle.
Right, right. It reaches people who are convinced that the internet is real life.
Right.
So I think the more of us who are like, I sound like Candace Owens right now, the more of us who are like, listen, everything you see on the internet can be manipulated. Like, when you see something online, you stop and you say, why am I seeing this? Why are they saying this? Could this be something? Is this real? Like, stopping and asking yourself, is this real? How can I verify if this is real? Like, is something that we all need to do. Because the more people realize that, like, we have ceded most of our communication to spaces that can be manipulated and are being manipulated.
There's no fact checking.
There's no fact checking, and there's no way to know how much of this is real and how much of this is, like, I think we need, the more people question how real Twitter is and Instagram and all that stuff, the better the safeguards are against all of us just being completely manipulated by it. You know, like,
right. I mean, influencers are not journalists.
Influencers are not journalists, and they have absolutely no problem just taking a like burlap sack with a dollar sign on the side from the Qatari government, you know? And I have to say, I'm not an influencer. I've had people offer me money to talk about things, and I've never ever agreed to do it. But like, you think about the amount of money we're talking about here, and it's like it gets to a certain point where it's probably hard for people to say no to it, especially if they don't really if they don't have a soul. And a lot of people kind of don't really have a soul. I just think this is something we really, as consumers of media, we need to talk about it. Because the big problem I have here, Alyssa, is, and we've touched on this, is like how many members of Congress and government officials live on Twitter, like Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee of Utah, is so online that I feel like if you took away his Twitter account, he would start having like tremors.
He'd have a conniption.
So like, how do we unfuck the situation where there are so many members of Congress who are just like cocaine rats hitting the button of like Twitter likes and retweets over and over again?
I think we just need new members of Congress.
I mean,
because they're not learning anything. Like, none of them are. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who aren't much better. You know what I mean? You're mm-hmm. like, just get off, read a book, like separate yourself. I think that that the way Donald Trump engages with social media makes it 10 times worse mm-hmm. because they see it as like his medium where he engages. And so they feel like being in that mix too is meaningful in some sort of way. But no, I mean, it's actually pretty wild. Like when you just, I was thinking about this. On the OSO, if we think about this in terms of, like I said, like lobbyists on steroids, political action committees, like things that are disclosed, you know that they have a position and they, on the Obama campaign in 2008, we didn't take federal lobbyists' money and we didn't take PAC money and lobbyists could not even work in the White House. If you had ever been a registered lobbyist, you couldn't work in the White House. And like what people, I think too, you know, part of why I think that what's happening is so dangerous is like some of the money that we're talking about, it's like a lot of fucking money these people are getting paid for. And like, for example, in New York State, if you engage in lobbying, if you take more than $5,000 in a year, you have to register as a lobbyist. So people know that this is your job. It's what you do. $5,000, Erin. Like, and you have to declare it. What, of course, like, on the one hand, it's like they're paying a lot more to these like influencers who are probably just tweeting to bots, but it's like a real example of sort of how out of control, like, our information, like, how the information we're taking in is labeled.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not at all. Whereas, like, before we were like, oh no, lobbying is bad.
Well, and then also we have people in power that are like, I mean, so there's so many old people that are so overrepresented that don't have the savvy to like not fall for things like AI. Like our associate producer Claire was telling us that there was a government official in her county that like posted something to Facebook that was like clearly AI or altered media after some flooding in her county, and that people were like, and that even when he was called out, he was kind of like, well, I don't know, who could say? And it's like,
that's the point.
Yeah.
If it's who can say, why are you posting it?
Because people are—
Jesus Christ.
People are cokeheads for likes. People are just— it's literally the stage of a party where it's like long past time to go home. And everybody who's still there is crouched around a coffee table doing lines. Like, that is literally what the government is when it comes to social media right now.
My God, you just made me think of the movie Boogie Nights.
I mean,
like, everyone go home. Like, take your roller skates off and go home.
Yes, exactly. It's like, everyone go home. I mean, now that we know that influencers and creators are being bought, because why wouldn't they be? You know, it's tempting to kind of question everything. Like, do you listen to Las Culturistas? Do you listen to that podcast?
You know, on occasion. But I did, this actually turned up in my FYP page.
Okay. So,
which was a lot of, angry people thinking that when Boanyang and Matt Rogers were talking about James Tallarico down in Texas, and it was strange. It felt like a real sort of swerve for them.
Yeah.
And they said so
they don't they don't really talk about politics.
No,
on
they're
the
Las
podcast.
Culturistas.
They're,
you know?
Yes, right.
I like not, their celebrity content.
Right.
Culture.
It's celebrity content. And then they sort of like took a turn and suddenly started discouraging listeners from contributing to Jasmine
in
Crockett's
the
Senate
weirdest,
campaign.
Like not lighthearted way. Like, it felt weirdly serious for them.
Yeah.
And they very specifically were saying not to give Jasmine Crockett money, not to donate money to her. And it just felt so strange. And so a lot of people online started speculating that they were being paid by James Tallarico. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that's fucking true, but in the world we live in, I was like, I don't know, it could make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Meredith Lynch, friend of Hysteria. She was at Crooked Con, if anybody was there. She's amazing.
She was on your panel.
But she's like speculated, like, how do we know these people aren't getting paid? And I think, you know, we don't have evidence that they are getting paid.
Because there's no disclosure requirement.
But we also have to question that. Like, the media environment we're in right now is like, that's a valid question, you know? I don't know if it's a valid accusation, but I think it's a valid question to be like, why did they suddenly bring this up? Why were they? And I just have to say, like, look, I know my hackles are up. I'm a lady. But I feel like if you are two guys who host a culture podcast, going hard against a black woman running for Senate is a really fucking bad look. You know? Like, you know?
It feels
even if you're
like
a fun culture person.
And
or,
look, it's like, and I do think it's like they have talked about politics before, but it just felt so out of left field. It felt like a weird non sequitur. And then to just also, there was a way to do it, in my opinion, which is be like, you know what? We talked to James Tallarico and we really fucking like him. And we think you guys should check him out, blah, 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 blah. There didn't need to be the don't donate to Jasmine Crockett. Like, that's the part that was so strange.
It was strange because also they know better. Like, if they were doing a pop culture story and there was like, okay, if we tell the story this way, it's going to make somebody mad in a way. They're going to catch a stray that, like, they don't need to be kept. Like, there's a way to, it's funny because they're more political about the way they talk about pop culture than they are when they how they talk about politics. Like, it's thorny. It's thorny. And you're stepping into a lane that isn't your lane. And you're not checking for where the traffic is coming from. Like,
well, exactly. And also, this isn't James Tallarico running against Ted Cruz and them saying not to give Ted Cruz money. Like, these are people who have more similarities than differences.
Yeah.
You know, to have such a strident view about not donating to Jasmine Crockett.
It was.
That was the part. It just felt weird.
It also was like a moment where I was like, are we really going to fucking do this again? Is the left going to just eat itself? Like, are you kidding me? We've got bigger fish to fry. We've got the biggest fish to fry.
Let them have some debates. People in Texas make up your minds.
It's like you're not
Go
from Texas.
God.
You're not like, you're not a, like, just, you don't need to do this. You don't need to, you didn't need to do this. And I think that it all kind of comes back to like, is it possible that a campaign would do some back channel reaching out to some podcasts that were popular?
For sure.
Yes. But like, it is another way in which living in this world is exhausting. That now I have to be like, is this real? Is this story of Donald Trump farting, which sounds like it could be real, real? Now I have to devote 10 minutes to researching his farts. Like, that's the world we're living in now, because AI bots, like, it's all.
Well, and there are assumptions that we make, right? It's like, I think that if someone came to you and I and was like, I would really love your support, we'd be like, well, why don't you come on the show and talk about what you believe? Do you know what I mean? Like, you assume. So it's like James Tallarico could have gone on the show. And I guess that's why, like, we also come from a position where it's like, well, no, like, you have a platform. So, like, you know, it matters. It matters not just what you say, but how you say it and what you don't say.
Yeah. And another thing is, like, I think for podcasters or creators or influencers or whatever, I think this is a good lesson that sneaky shit, if you're doing sneaky shit or you're sounding like you're doing sneaky shit, it's going to cause like way more problems than just being like straightforward about it. Like you suggested.
Yeah.
Just having him come on the show and talk about his campaign.
For sure. You can give him softball questions or do a whole pop culture interview with him, but just like, I don't know.
Yeah, that was weird. But it also, like, I feel like now everybody has to be very skeptical of everything that they're taking in, even their favorite culture podcast. Yeah. Because we know that the right uses the kind of no guardrails media environment to further whatever they want, and nobody has any morals around it. Nobody has any nobody has any ethics around anything. So, you know, I just really wanted everyone who's listening to just take a beat today and think about, you know, how do you consume news? And like the way that legacy media organizations used to function as a flawed but usually effective way to make sure that the information that you were getting had been at least vetted or had been or was coming at you without an agenda. Mainstream media used to like the reason journalism school exists and the reason that there are ethics in journalism is because journalism ultimately aims to tell the truth. And if we're in a world now where like the legacy media that aimed to tell the truth and had guardrails up is now being completely derided and defunded and ignored. And so now what we have is just a bunch of liars and shills. And
what a bummer.
Yeah. What a bummer.
Measure twice, cut once
measure
when
twice,
it comes to your information.
Absolutely. Before you hit the share button, double check. And I've fallen for stuff too.
I have to, but I really do try. I mean, same as you, Erin. It's like, I see something. If something's like too good to be true, I'm like, I'm just going to Google. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to like take it off or take it to Reddit and see like what Reddit has to say about it.
Yeah. Another thing I fall for sometimes is I fall for like real doom and gloom stuff. And I've gotten to a point where I catch myself now and I try to go and verify doom and gloom stuff and make sure it's as bad as people say, because getting people riled up is good for engagement. So a lot of times, yeah. So we'll see stories that are like even worse versions of a bad story that are sort of exaggerating how bad something is. Like, here's an example, the vaccines thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The vaccine schedule thing where people are like, now, you know, you can't get vaccines. Your kids can't get vaccines anymore because of this.
Right. Or that it won't be covered by insurance.
Yes.
There was a lot of like, but yes, it is.
And it's possible that eventually that will be true.
Right.
But to tell people that it is currently true is like a misrepresentation that like also is unhelpful. Because
I think— You know what's funny?
What's funny?
I was going to say, you said you fall for doom and gloom. Uh-huh. I fall for the opposite.
Oh, really?
Like I like watched this video and I was like, this is so amazing. And it was like these people in a stadium and there was like a dog rescue event and the dog got to pick the person. And then I watched it and I was like, fuck me. I think this is AI.
That's AI.
Yeah, totally. It took me a minute. And then I was like, how'd they get this many people? I was like, Jesus Christ, Elizabeth, I'm scrolling.
All right. Well, be wary, everybody, of things that are too good to be true, too bad to be true. Or if suddenly, mysteriously, everybody is expressing an opinion that you're like, wait a minute, only psychos would believe that. That's also probably paid content.
Yeah.
All right.
Probably.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sani Petty. Hysteria is brought to you by Brodo. Alyssa.
Yes.
We have been talking about Brodo off mic.
Love Brodo. Look, here is my Brodo.
She's currently got
Eastwork
a cup
mug.
Cup of, oh my God, that's such a great mug.
Mm-hmm.
Cup of broth. Cup of
it's
broth.
Perfect.
If your morning coffee isn't cutting it lately, what if instead you reach for a steaming cup of something nourishing? Bone broth.
I've
done
it.
You know what? That is a great idea. Alyssa's currently doing it. If you've ever tried bone broth and hated the taste, why would you hate? I've never tried bone broth and hated the taste. But if you have tried Brodo bone broth and then tried another bone broth,
different experience entirely.
Different experience, because going from Brodo to any other kind of bone broth is like a downgrade.
It is a downgrade.
It's a downgrade. Our next sponsor makes bone broth so good, I can't stop eating it. If you've been on social media lately, I'm sure you've heard people talking about the importance of gut health.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you actually get better gut health, especially in colder months? Brodo's bone broth. This podcast is sponsored by Brodo. Welcome to the hottest trend in nutrition for the last 2,000 years, bone broth. Brodo's bone broths are made from scratch, no concentrates, preservatives, or shortcuts, so you get the best broth money can buy.
Brodo makes bone broths that are delicious enough to drink. Each cup delivers whole food protein, about 10 grams per serving, along with collagen-building amino acids, electrolytes, and nutrients to support gut health, immunity, joints, skin, and general wellness, all under 50 calories and with zero sugar or fat. I have to tell you, a year ago, my doctor actually told me that she wanted me drinking, because I have such a bad gut, 2 cups of bone broth a day. And do you want to know what? I'm off all my tummy medication.
What?
I'm not calling it medication, but I am saying that she told me I needed to soothe my gut and I wanted to do it in a way so I didn't have to take medication anymore. And bone broth really helps. I can physically feel the difference. It settles my tummy. And we're always being told to be more hydrated. Perfect way to be more hydrated.
You. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Brodo was launched by award-winning chef Marco Conera. He started selling Brodo out of the side door of his East Village Manhattan restaurant 11 mm-hmm. years ago. Honestly, some of the best food is sold out of a side door. It starts being sold out of a side door. And now, whether you want a quick warm drink or a nourishing base for cooking, Brodo makes it easy. They ship nationwide, so you don't have to be in New York City to enjoy Chef Marco's masterpiece.
Alyssa, do you know, I have been drinking him since—
You've been drinking him?
I've been drinking him since he was selling it out of his restaurant.
What? That's amazing.
Yes, it's right down the street from me.
I literally, after we get done recording this ad, I'm going to pull up a recipe and I'm going to make a delicious soup with— I know
amazing.
That like you can just drink it straight up and that's like probably the ideal, purest way to consume Brodo bone broth, but I think I'm going to make a soup with it tonight and I'm going to report
back. I've
made
soup with it. I've cooked pasta with it and done like a little soupy pasta with some spinach and a little grated pecorino on top.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. That sounds great. Shop the best broth on the planet with Brodo. Head to brodo.com/hysteria for 20% off your first subscription order and use code hysteria for an additional $10 off. Once again, that's brodo.com/hysteria for 20% off your first subscription order and an additional $10 off if you use my promo code hysteria. And welcome back. You're listening to Hysteria, the podcast that believes that desperate times call for desperate measures.
Ba-dum-bum.
I haven't heard that wordplay, and I was very proud of it.
It's excellent.
When
it's
I came
excellent.
Up with it at 3 a.m. because I couldn't sleep, and then I giggled to myself and laid awake.
And I giggled too.
Oh, thank you so much. Before we get to Sandy Petty, some announcements for the class. The situation in Iran, which we didn't even talk about on this show.
Nope. Because
it's escalating. That's alarming. We don't like it.
Very. Nope.
Iranians have taken to the streets repeatedly over the last 17 years to protest their authoritarian government. But right now, the demonstrations are appearing to be the largest yet. Over 2,000 people have died, at least. There's divergent reports, but that number is rising. Mm-hmm. To understand how the country got there, tune into Crooked's foreign policy podcast, Pod Save the World. It's indispensable during times of crisis. It's indispensable always, but especially during times like this where it is— something is happening as a result of a complicated series of factors.
Don't listen to TikTok. Listen to Ben and
Listen
Tommy.
To Ben and Tommy. This week, hosts Tommy Vitor and Ben Rhodes unpack the latest out of Iran, Venezuela, and their oil industry, and growing threats to Mexico and Cuba.
Plus, they sit down with Jason Rezaian, an Iranian-American journalist who was wrongfully detained in Iran 10 years ago. Tune into Pod Save the World wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Okay, now let's get to Sandy Petty. I've got a Sandy.
Hit me.
Okay. So I'm rarely home alone at night and able to pick what I watch on TV.
Okay.
But when I am, I like to watch stand-up comedy. But
great. Me too.
I like to watch stand-up comedy. Recently, I watched a stand-up special called Father by Atsuko Okatsuka.
Mm.
And it's fucking amazing.
Awesome.
She's so—
We need funny.
So Atsuko has been on Love It or Leave It before. She was on an episode that I was on. I don't know if she's been on multiple times, but she was just like lovely in person. And she was super funny on Love It or Leave It. But I hadn't like watched her stand-up comedy before. And Father, which I think is available on Hulu, is so funny. There was never a moment where I was like, kind of, okay, this is her run of bad jokes. They were
right, the carnations. There was no filler flower in her set.
They were all good. Also, like, the production design of it was like amazing. She looks incredible. Like, the outfit she's wearing is amazing. Like, the backdrop is cool. Like, it's so visually interesting. She's so, like, she does some act out. She does some physical comedy. Her jokes are like, never did I cringe, and there's always one where I'm like, that's— like, whenever I watch even, like, the best stand-up comedians, there's usually one where I'm like, that sucked. But she's just it's a banger, front to back.
Awesome.
It's a total banger. So if you—
Where can I find it?
It's on Hulu.
Hulu. Great.
It's on Hulu. And, yeah, she's just super funny and amazing. And if you just want to, like, not disconnect from the world, but just feel light and—
Take a little breather.
Take a breather. Have some laughs. Absolutely, check that out. All right, Alyssa, Sandy or Petty this week?
Sandy.
Okay.
Aaron, Bob Weir died.
Okay.
This was very—
I immediately thought about you when I saw.
So I was at dinner, and one of the beautiful things about this podcast is that it brought a woman named Patty into my life who is married to Jeffrey, who is a sound mixer for the Grateful Dead. I've been friends with them for years. And
what?
I was at dinner. Yes, yes.
Okay.
And just that day, he'd been the sound mixer, I think, for most of the Grateful Dead's history. And they had sent me these beautiful records, these Grateful Dead records for Christmas. And I was like, you know what? I've got to call Patty. And I see she calls me. And it turned out she was calling to give me the heads up. Oh my God, I'm going to get so sad that Bob died. And he was just so, like, when I left the White House, Bob invited me to join a voter registration, a nonpartisan voter registration board. Getting to know him was, like, one of the honors of my life. And in, like, a world that was so bad, it was so sad that he left. But here's the Sandy. Hold on. I didn't mean to get upset.
I mean, we're living in upsetting times, Alyssa.
I know. And I was just like, and I just got home. I went home. I sat down on the kitchen floor with the cats and I just like cried and texted all of my like dead friends who I'd made over the years. But here's what I want. If anyone ever loved the Grateful Dead, ever loved Bob Weir, they know that the whole ethos of the Dead is that the music goes on. The Grateful Dead were one of the true like real grassroots movement. They always wanted the music to be free. They never wanted money to be a barrier to entry. You know, like they always put the audience experience. Like DK and I watched the Taylor Swift documentary. And when I was watching it, I was like, oh my God, like Deadheads walked so Swifties could run, you know, like audience experience and like the vibes and everything.
Yeah.
And so, but one great group in the spirit of the music going on, one of the greatest people who I follow who did a beautiful tribute is the only Grateful Dead drag band, and they are called Bertha. And they are exceptional. They're going on tour. If you love the Grateful Dead, if they meant anything to you, or God forbid, if they were important to your parents, you know, like, and the memories, the music holds any sort of memories. I mean, one, there's so much music that that you can find everywhere that is Grateful Dead, but it was truly joyful and beautiful to listen to Bertha's tribute, and they're terrific. So you can find them. They're touring across the country. They're going to be in Vermont. They're going to be in Woodstock, New York. I'm hoping to go see them, and places across the country. And we'll link to them in our show notes so you can find them.
Oh, Alyssa, well, RIP Bob Weir.
RIP Bob.
That's all the time we have for this week's episode of Hysteria. Alyssa, about to do a spit take. Liquid going down the wrong tube.
Oh, too much, too fast.
Thank you for being my ride or die this week and every week. We also want to thank Reshma Sujani for joining us and for all of her hard work and accomplishments. Listeners, if you want to get in touch, you can get in touch to vent, get in touch to tip us, get in touch to just say hi.
Send us a story.
Send us a story. If you have like a correction, you notice we got something wrong, send us the correction. You guys are
nicely.
Always like, yeah, I mean, they're always
because
nice.
It's not intentional.
They're always, we never do it on purpose, but we do like to be correct. So if we got something wrong, like let us know, but don't be a jerk, right?
Right.
You can email us at hysteria@crooked.com. Also, if you join the Friends of the Pod community, you can reach us on Discord. We're there. Mm-hmm. We jump in and we chit chat sometimes. And there will be more Hysteria for you next week. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Subscribe to Hysteria on YouTube for access to video versions of your favorite segments and other exclusive content. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a nice review. Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Caroline Reston is our senior producer. Our executive producer is me, Aaron Ryan. And Alyssa Mastromonaco is our co-producer. Claire Fogarty is our associate producer. The show is engineered and edited by Jordan Cantor. We get audio support from Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Our video producers are Rachel Guy and Claudia Sheng. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Adrian Hill is our head of news and politics. Kendra James is our executive producer of culture and entertainment. And thank you to Daisy Cruz and David Tolles for production and marketing support every week. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.